This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham.
The first time he was here, technology historian Peter Norton told us about how some 80 years ago, the car industry made up a word. And with that one single word, managed to change the face of America's landscape. The second time he was here, Dr. Norton explained the societal significance of the one thing Star Trek's Captain Kirk was never seen to do while talking on his flip phone. So the third time's the charm, right? Well, it turns out this Virginia-based researcher has lately been paying attention to what well may be the beginnings of a worldwide revolution in roads. Yep, across the land and across the globe, it turns out people are challenging the notion of what streets and roads are made for. We'll ask Peter to fill in specifics, but he's probably going to invite you to brainstorm with him as well, so get ready. Another Norton mind-melding hour is coming up right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Here's this hour's word association game. I say street, and you say the first word or words that come to mind. Okay? Street. And cars, certainly. Trucks, of course. Bicycles, good, good. Okay, I've got my ESP going full steam here. Someone says go-karts, golf carts, shopping carts, crosswalks. Okay, now rather than you just thinking a word or idea, we're going to ask you to actually call your suggestions on how to reimagine using streets and roads, whether you believe there might indeed be improvements possible to how most of us use public roadways these days. 888-WMRA-TALK is the way to call your ideas and suggestions in. Easy to remember that way, 888-WMRA-TALK. But if you prefer all numbers, then it translates to 888-967-2825. And here to help get our mental juices flowing, a technology historian who's already been noting lots of changes and how places around the world have been experimenting, it is a great pleasure to welcome back to the Insight Studios, Peter Norton.
Thank you, Tom.
Peter, it's become something of a tradition that when you stop by, you bring along with you a technology trivia question for the audience. Did you bring one today?
That's right. I'm too cheap to bring you a real gift, but we'll settle for a word game instead. I think this will be the third time we've done that. First time we talked. Well, actually, it was the second time we talked.
Well, actually, if I can just get you to give out this
trivia
question.
Yeah, we'll start with today's.
And then we'll go back to the other times while we're waiting for everybody to fill up the phone lines with the answer for today's.
Okay,
so today's trivia question has something to do with roads.
Yeah, and it's a word, maybe a word you might not have heard before, and so we don't want to make it too easy. But maybe somebody has, or somebody can piece together what it might mean. It's a new trend. It's called Copenhagenizing. The question is, what is it, Copenhagenizing?
Copenhagenizing. And we've already given away a clue, and that we're talking about reimagining uses of streets and roads, and the word itself might be a clue. Okay,
that's right.
So anybody who thinks they know what Copenhagenizing is, or how to pronounce it, the phone number, all our lines are open at the moment at 888-WMRA-TALK. Same prize for the winner as the last time you were
here?
Yeah,
I think some well-deserved applause is appropriate.
Because it's about all we can afford.
That's right. Yeah,
it's a low-budget nonprofit radio station. If you think you know what Copenhagenizing is, 888-967-2825. We'd love to hear your best guess. Now, let's look at the last couple of times you were here.
Right. And I want to stick in the fact that I've heard the applause, and it is awesome and not to be missed.
I should note that we are going to skip around here a lot this hour. So if you listening hear us mention something, and by the time you get to the phone, we seem to have gone on to something else, we still want to hear your thoughts on that previous something at 888-WMRA-TALK. And while we wait to see if we have any takers or correct answers for Copenhagenizing trivia quiz, now, all of a sudden, all the lines are filled up. So if you're getting a busy signal, be patient. Call back. I'm guessing the first couple of people are probably not going to get this right. Peter, there is something else I thought I ought to ask you about. It's just possible that someone listening has actually missed one of your previous visits with us. So could you repeat for us the answers from those trivia revelations I noted at the top of the hour, the one about Captain Kirk,
right,
and the other probably even more connected to today's discussion has to do with a single word that the car industry manufactured that seemed to have changed America's future. Let's do Star Trek first, though.
Okay. Yeah, I think both of these are connected to today's subject in a way. The one about Captain Kirk, we were talking about how people and technology interact in surprising ways. And it turned out that people were already predicting the cell phone way back in the 1960s because, you know, the communicator on Star Trek is basically a cell phone. And I asked the audience, what did Captain Kirk never do with a cell phone that we do almost all the time? And the answer
was walk.
Walk, yeah.
He's a move around with his phone.
Yeah, he just stands still as if there's a cord. And I think that's telling us something interesting, which is we can imagine imagine the future in terms of what a technology will look like, but we still retain our ways of thinking about them from an earlier time.
And then the word. And this is actually a pretty long story, so I'm going to ask you to give us the shortened version.
I'll give you the short version. There was a word that was invented by people who wanted to sell cars in cities back 90 years ago or so, and they needed a way to tell pedestrians that they didn't belong in the streets, which was a wild and crazy idea back then. And so they came
because
up
back then, city streets were almost like city parks. I mean, everybody just hung out in the street.
That's exactly right. It was just like a city park. You could go in and do whatever you wanted. You couldn't get in trouble with the law for walking in the street. And people did it all the time and felt like they had the right to do it.
And the car industry was getting a bad rap because there were accidents where drivers weren't being careful, hitting people, especially hitting children with their cars.
Yeah, and that doesn't look good when you're doing that. And so they needed a way to sort of redirect the blame. So to redirect the blame back at the pedestrian, they came up with a nice little insult, which used to have a lot of sting. You can tell from the old letters to the editor because people complained about the word pretty angrily. The word was jaywalker, which was just a way to ridicule pedestrians to make them not roam in the street at will.
And that word, the whole idea of jaywalking, that if you did not cross the street at a proper cross section or crosswalk, you were somehow doing something wrong, was a completely new idea. It was promoting the idea that the streets really belonged to cars and motor vehicles, not to pedestrians. But it also came from a sort of derisive term. Do I remember, Peter, somewhere in the...
That's
in
right.
The Midwest?
That's right. Yeah, the word jay, especially in the American Midwest, was a term of insult for what we might call a hick today, somebody from the countryside, allegedly not well-educated, and talks a lot without saying much because that's what a jaybird does.
Okay. So we have now, in case you've missed our previous visits with Dr. Peter Norton, reinformed you of the previous answers to his trivia questions. Let's take a look at what we've got for people calling in about Copenhagen icing. First call coming in from Stanton. Dennis, you're on the air. What do you think Copenhagen icing means?
I believe it's when you recapture roads and pave surfaces for green uses, kind of reimagining them.
That's awfully close, isn't it?
I think it's very close. I mean,
before you, because there's somebody else here.
Well, I was just going to say,
who's going to compliment this?
Okay, I wonder if we could be more specific about what a green use is.
Oh, okay, Dennis. Did you get Peter's question?
A cop whizzed by me, and I couldn't hear him over the phone.
Yeah, that can be distracting. Dr. Morton,
yeah,
repeat your question.
I just wanted to know if you could be a little bit more specific when you say green use, and if you can be sure to treat the police officer like a gentleman. That will be to your benefit.
Yes. When I say green use, usually when you get urban development, you kind of lose a lot of the uses that people get used to for the outdoors, places to play, places to picnic, places to hang out and have a nice day. And people kind of imagine them as places they can sit back, read, set up a picnic table, play a game of cards, things like that.
Dennis, there is this piece of technology I'm dealing with here. I have a computer screen in front of me, and it shows me when calls come in, even though it's the other producers who answer the phone. And Leah from Charlotte, North Carolina, called at exactly the same moment that you did. So before I let Peter talk about how close you are or are not in your answer, can we also hear what Leah has to say?
Sure. Great. Thank you.
Hold on, Dennis. Don't go away. Leah, you're on Virginia Insight. What do you think Copenhagenizing means?
I believe it means to convert to transportation largely by bicycle. So, for instance, he was talking about roadway conversion for green use. I was specifying that it was green use for bicycle use.
I think that's spot on.
Well, no, wait. Hold on just a second. I have to ask this question. Don't Dennis and Leah both kind of win the award?
Well, can you split the applause?
Dennis and Leah, this is for both of you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Engineering and technology historian Peter Norton is our guest. We're mostly going to be talking this hour about how we could reimagine use of roads and streets and what's already being done in other places around the world. If you have questions or comments other than the trivia question that we just got addressed, you're welcome to join the conversation at 888-WMRA-TALK. Ton Dang, who works with the city of Harrisonburg on public transportation and who I believe is attending a conference in Richmond today, has been kind enough to call us in here and tell us, Ton, I think you've got some ideas on how you think roads and streets could be reimagined.
Yeah, we in Harrisonburg have a pretty built environment already with existing roadways, but you know, there's always opportunities for, you know, considering things like road diets, where we might have a four-lane facility, and maybe there's an opportunity to make it more safe and to add bike lanes on it and reducing the number of travel lanes, say from four to three for vehicles, and have room for bike lanes. But I think for transportation and getting around, also there's also opportunities that are separated from the roadway that might connect schools, neighborhoods, and city parks. You know, on what we may, I guess some people perceive as the backside of those properties or those developments. But, you know, it's safer, maybe more comfortable. Maybe there's opportunities to be surrounded by trees in a little more kind of a nature-type setting when you look at other opportunities, not just the roadways.
Well, I'm impressed with what you're already doing in Harrisonburg. I was just reading about the North End Greenway, which I understand was approved for funding by City Council in Harrisonburg last night.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I just that to me is a sign that that Harrisonburg is reimagining what it can do. It doesn't have to follow what we thought was the only way before. All over the world, including Harrisonburg, people are figuring out that we can do all kinds of things besides just accommodate cars.
Yeah, that is correct. Yeah, and City Council had appropriated funding for half of the project, so we are, you know, on our way with moving forward with that. And right now in Harrisonburg, we don't have any of those facilities yet in place, but I mean, we're getting closer from visioning to actually having these projects in the next, you know, couple of years. So it's an exciting time.
Great.
Tom, we're about to hit the break, but I just want to ask you real quickly. You used a term that perked up my ears, maybe because I'm always thinking about dieting, but you said road diet. Can you explain what that means?
Yeah, sure. Road diets is when you have an existing roadway, and I guess it's a diet because you're shrinking the footprint of, I think, generally, you know, the vehicular footprint. So you might have a road that's four lanes, and you reduce it to three. There's also opportunities for lane diets where you borrow the width from existing vehicular travel lanes to make room for bike lanes, which we've done on South Main Street in front of James Madison University.
Ton Dang, who is the public works planner for the city of Harrisonburg and works on city and bicycle pedestrian coordination. I hope I got that close to right, Ton. Thank you so much for joining us. We're going to continue here on Virginia Insight in just a moment.
Why don't we do it in the road? 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 No one will be watching us. Why don't we do it in the road?
Well, not to take anything away from the Beatles, but what have you done in the road that you could talk about that might qualify as different than the usual? 888-WMRA-TALK is how to reach us by phone. That's 888-967-2825. On Facebook, find us listed as Virginia Insight. Historian of technology and culture, Peter Norton is our guest. His most recent book is titled Fighting Traffic, The Dawn of the Motor Age in the American City. Let's go back to a non-American city, if we could, Peter. Copenhagen. A little more explanation about what they're doing there.
Yeah, our trivia word was Copenhagenizing, and I think people might want to know where that comes from. In the 50s and 60s, European cities were mostly learning how to handle traffic from Americans, which meant accommodating cars above everything else. And Copenhagen began to question this, and they had a planner there named Jan Gehl. He's still active today, but in 1962, he started to ask some questions that really weren't questions people were allowed to ask until he started asking them, like, do we really want to accommodate every car that comes into Copenhagen? Will we have to demolish buildings to make room for parking for them all? Does it make it harder for people to walk and bike in Copenhagen? So they began to let him do some things that other cities have been imitating ever since, hence the word Copenhagenizing. That means things like gradually reducing the amount of parking that people could find, while at the same time opening up bike lanes, bike paths, pedestrian zones. In 1962, Copenhagen introduced one of the first large pedestrian zones in the world, which was followed, imitated worldwide, like Charlottesville. 1976 introduced a pedestrian zone, and it was a completely contrary to the conventional wisdom of the time, which was that you really just want to accommodate cars wherever they can go. And the result in Copenhagen is that today, 2012, one third of people who go to work in Copenhagen go by bicycle. Compare that to New York City, which is, you know, relatively pedestrian friendly compared to a lot of places, and it's still only about 1%. So it's a real, very different model, and a model that is attractive to a lot of people.
And this started in Copenhagen more than 40 years ago.
That's right. And in fact, the guy who's really was behind it, Jan Gehl, is today still active and advising Mike Bloomberg in New York City, where he's really sold Mike Bloomberg, the mayor, on this idea. Bloomberg says that by 2030, he wants 500 miles of dedicated bike pathways separated from traffic, and another 1,300 miles of bike lanes, the painted bike lanes on regular streets. So it's a major project. It's controversial, but it's Bloomberg wants to Copenhagenize New York.
Are there other places in the world that have successfully imitated the Copenhagen model?
Absolutely. In some ways, I think you could almost say that the better word would be Netherlandsizing. Because the whole country, the Netherlands, has been substantially converted to bicycling and walking. In fact, if you find a parking garage in the Netherlands, it's probably for bicycles. They have multi-level bicycle parking garages there called fietsvlots, which means bike apartment house.
Wait a minute. Repeat that word.
There's a
fiets who?
There's a Dutch word, and I don't speak Dutch, so I'm probably mispronouncing it, but the word is fietsvlots, which means bicycle apartment house. It's a multi-level parking garage. It looks, actually, you might mistake it for a car parking garage at first because it looks a lot the same, but it can hold thousands of bicycles, unlike the hundreds of cars that a parking garage can hold. And a lot of Dutch people use them to park their bike where they catch the train. And we have a whole country that's getting to work and getting home on a combination of train and bike.
So technology historian Peter Norton, is there any information, any way of knowing how satisfied that the people who live in Copenhagen or other places in the Netherlands are doing this with this sort of transportation model, and how it causes kind of differences, if it does, in a sense of community in a given city?
Well, actually, those things have been studied. I mean, there's a lot of ways I could answer that question, but I think maybe the best is to talk about a book by Don Appleyard, published back in 1981, called Livable Streets. And Don Appleyard actually did a study. He took three similar streets in San Francisco. They were similar in every respect in terms of homeowners' income, block size, and so on, but they were different in one respect, which was one had a heavy amount of auto traffic, one had a moderate amount of auto traffic, and one had light auto traffic. And he did very intensive surveys of the people who lived on those streets. And the results are fascinating. One was that the people in the lightly traveled street thought of the whole block as their home. He called it their home turf, and they could accurately describe the whole block because they knew it intimately, like you know your own house or apartment, while the people who lived on the busy street only knew their apartment. And he also found that people on the lightly traveled streets had friends on that block that they frequently socialized with. In fact, one of the messages of Appleyard's book is that if you want friends, live on a lightly trafficked street where there's a lot of houses but not a lot of cars, because he found that on the heavily trafficked streets, people had an average of one friend on the same block. On the lightly traveled streets, they had an average of three. That's a big difference. And it suggests that a street can serve a function for social life, not just a function for getting around. And that, in fact, the more you accommodate the car, the harder it is to serve the social function of a street. And if you want to associate happiness with having friends and a social life, I think most people will go along with that.
Bogota, Colombia?
Yeah.
What are they doing there?
Bogota is a fascinating case. They had some very open-minded experimental mayors, one of them in particular named Antanas Mockus about 10 years ago. He didn't introduce all these ideas, but he really ran with them. One of the many ideas was something called ciclovia, which means bike path. But the sense of it, of the word in Bogota, was that once a week on Sunday, he would close 70 miles of streets in Bogota. They would be open for bicyclists and pedestrians only. There would be street performers, entertainments of various kinds, places to meet and socialize. And although at first these were, you know, controversial, they annoyed some people who wanted to drive, they've been a huge, huge success. And so much so that they're being imitated in the United States. There's a ciclovia that's just started in Atlanta called Atlanta Streets Alive. They close the streets down, and people are having a wonderful time. And
this is for like one day or several days? Or
I mean, it varies city by city. The one I can tell you about specifically is Bogota, where it's once a week every Sunday for a few hours.
All the streets? Or
No, about 70 miles of streets. So you can still get around by car. You have to avoid certain streets. And they're very successful. They're very popular. And they're opening people's minds up to the idea that a street not only can be a means of transportation, or moving your car, they can also be a place to meet people, a place to have fun, a place to walk, a place to ride a bike. And it changes the other 6 days a week, too, because a lot of people who didn't have a bike would get one for ciclovia, and then once they had a bike, they'd use it on the other days of the week, too, which is sort of changing a lot of people's ideas about how to get around.
So for you on the other side of your radio, do you recall a time when neighbors seemed to know each other better? Do you see anything associated with technology or even zoning or city planning that could have inadvertently ended up encouraging people to associate with their neighbors less? Have any ideas on how to change that? Our guest, technology historian Peter Norton, is happy to talk to you. All you have to do is call us at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. Or if you prefer, you can post a question or comment on our Facebook page where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Peter, tell me about something that I understand has been around for many, many decades in America and other places in the world, that was referred to as functional classification?
Yeah, it's an idea really that spread in the late 40s and in the 50s by traffic engineers. And the idea is that if you want to move cars quickly around a city, you better dedicate certain roads to certain purposes. So even if you haven't heard of functional classification, you might have heard about some of the categories of road. Like you have arterials for the major roads. Sometimes they're called primary roads. You have collector roads, and you have local roads. And the idea is that if you have, like you used to have in Manhattan Island, all the streets serving everybody, then everybody's going to be sort of jammed. Nobody will be able to go very fast. But if you have this functional classification system, which is what you see in the suburbs of America, then you can have quiet little local roads where there's not a lot of traffic by your house. And those feed into a collector road that's a little bigger. And that in turn takes you to a primary or arterial where the cars really move. It works beautifully in a world where everybody's driving and where that's really all you want to do is quickly get around by car. But it also causes some real problems for other people who want to use streets. For example, children can feel isolated in suburbs because functional classification works in part by reducing the frequency of intersections. So you can be 100 yards away from a supermarket, but to get to it, you might have to drive a mile. If you picture in your mind the average suburban subdivision, it's easy to see why. You think of cul-de-sacs and curved roads, infrequent intersections, and then you might have a major highway with a few pedestrian crossings. And so we sometimes complain that our children don't get outside enough and aren't active enough, but we've created a world for them where getting any place interesting, even to a friend's house, might make them have to walk twice as far or three times as far as the geographic distance they're actually traveling. And in a world like that, we have to drive our kids around. So a lot of people are saying what we need to do is start connecting roads more, including all classes of roads, so that people don't have to walk a mile to go 100 yards. So kids can walk to school. There's a growing trend to provide safe routes by which children can walk to school. Safe walk to school programs. There's one in Charlottesville, for example. And in general, there's a hope that we can find ways to make it possible for children to walk where they want to walk, and other people who want to walk, to go to destinations like the supermarket, to be able to get a bottle of ibuprofen without having to get in the car. And functional classification is a barrier to that.
888-WMRA Talk, the easy way to remember our phone number. Technology historian Peter Norton, our guest. To Forestville now. Lee, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment for Dr. Norton, please.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering if your guest could speak about the High Line in New York City, where they've repositioned an old elevated subway track to like 15 blocks of green space up the west side of Manhattan Island. And my other thought is all the towns around here, when the malls came in, they started building parking garages to try and bring car traffic back downtown. And a lot of that capacity is never really used up. But that would make a perfect little parks around the town where you could put in fountains or tennis courts or basketball courts and with a little bit of no trouble at all. So those are my two things. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling. I'll take your second question first. There's a superabundance of parking provision in the cities and suburbs of this country, and a lot of it could be reused for a lot of wonderful alternatives. We have another barrier, kind of like functional classification was a barrier, which is zoning ordinances. A lot of them specify that a retail business must provide X number of off-street parking spaces. So if you have a certain square footage of retail floor space, you have to provide a comparable amount of parking space. Typically, you end up with as much surface parking as there is floor space in a store. And not only does this end up dedicating a lot of land to parking. It also means that you discourage other ways of getting around because you're incentivizing people by providing them parking that seems to be free. And at the same time, you're disincentivizing people from using alternatives. Like, buses have a harder time getting you where you need to go when the stores are all separated by huge parking lots. And of course, if you're walking or bicycling, it's harder to get around when the stores are separated by huge parking lots. And so it's a big factor in urban sprawl. And I'd like to just recommend a book called The High Cost of Free Parking by Don Shoup, who's shown that actually this parking, which seems to be free, of course, is just being paid for in the prices of the goods that you buy from the stores and so on, and is using up a huge amount of land. So in other words, even if people want to reuse those parking spaces for some of those suggestions that Lee provided, it's going to be a problem because it might end up violating a zoning ordinance. And so there are a lot of suggestions that we change our zoning codes so that we permit people to provide less off-street parking, and then maybe we can do other things with our land besides park cars on them. And about the High Line in New York City, this is an elevated railway line where instead of running trains, all kinds of alternative uses are being taken up on it. And it is one example of countless ones of reclaiming space. Usually when the space is reclaimed, it's streets. And so there's a big trend called street reclaiming. And street reclaiming is sometimes official. In other words, the city officially provides alternative uses for the street space. A lot of it is unofficial. Residents, for example, who are tired of having fast cars going in front of their houses in a city will sometimes do something, well, it goes by many names. One of them is chair bombing. That means they'll just put a lot of chairs out in the street. People will come and sit in them and socialize. And although it sounds almost suicidal, it turns out to be perfectly safe because the cars coming down the street will see the chairs and either take a different street or drive very slowly. And so this becomes a kind of unofficial redefinition of the street, changing it into shared space, which is a term a lot of people use for this practice. And it's a good illustration of the fact that a lot of this reimagining of streets is totally unofficial. I think that there's a useful analogy here with Wikipedia. You guys, a lot of people in the audience will remember when the paragon of encyclopedias was Encyclopedia Britannica. So in the 90s, I thought that was it. That was going to be the best encyclopedia there could ever be. And it was made by people who seemed infinitely smart in some mysterious place, maybe in Oxford, sitting in a stone Gothic building. And now we have Wikipedia. Wikipedia shows that ordinary people can get together, correct each other's mistakes, and produce a wonderful encyclopedia article. Something kind of like that
so
is going on with streets.
Don't have to depend just on the experts.
Exactly.
The rest of us can have an impact.
That's right.
And I think you've got some more stories of the kinds of impact that are happening, not only other places in the world, but other places in the U.S. So we're going to ask historian Peter Norton to tell us more about that and more of how this all relates to environmental concerns when we continue here on Virginia Insight. Talking Heads, Road to Nowhere. Oh, somewhere right now is someone listening who's thinking about how differently they have experienced the community in which they live under differently engineered transportation experiences. Different when you're riding a bike, certainly, than when you're in a car. Motorcycle, different from riding a bus. Walking, different than anything else. Well, if you are the person who's been thinking about such things, we'd love to hear more about those specific thoughts and how they look inside your head. 888-WMRA-TALK is the phone number, 888-967-2825. Or if you prefer to type instead of talk, you can reach us on Facebook at WMRA's Virginia Insight. Peter Norton is our guest. He is an historian who teaches in the engineering school at the University of Virginia as part of that school's Department of Science, Technology, and Society. I'm Tom Graham. Peter, I know that I've heard you express concern before that there are big issues, particularly things related to the environment, that people feel overwhelmed about. They just don't feel like, as one individual, they can have much impact on something like climate change. But that's not your view. And the kinds of things we're talking about today, you see as proof that people can have an impact.
Well, I want to make a confession to you. Here I am talking about other things we can do with streets and roads. And to get here, I drove. And to get to work every day, I drive. And I have a little story I tell myself as a kind of consolation, which is, well, the whole world's built for drivers. So I, you know, there I have to conform with it. Because I don't like riding a bike when a car is going to pass me by a couple of inches or maybe even honk at me because they think I don't belong in the road. Well, I mean, this is why I'm actually encouraged by people who are more bold than I am, who will actually go out and show people how we can actually reconsider all of these things. So, I mean, I mentioned chair bombing a little while ago. This is when residents will put chairs in a street and show that it can serve social functions. Well, I mean, there's things people are doing to encourage us to recognize the alternatives we have for getting around. Some of these things are controversial. I'll give you one example of that. Maybe some of the listeners have heard of critical mass. This is a sort of disorganized movement of bicyclists. It began in San Francisco in 1992. A bunch of bicyclists just got together and decided they were going to sort of take over the street, right? And by moving as a herd, they effectively took over the street. And from a lot of people's point of view, this was an obnoxious thing to do. It was kind of, interfering with other people using the streets for what they thought streets are for. On the other hand, it also made people think, hey, you know, maybe bicycling around cities is a cleaner, greener, healthier alternative to driving. And one indication that some people look at it that way is that the movement spread. This goes on once a month in over 300 cities worldwide from that one beginning in San Francisco. And this is visibly showing people that there are alternatives to what we mostly grew up believing, which was that the only way to get around for any significant distance is to drive a car. They're helping us look at bicycles as something besides a child's toy or a fitness device, which are two typical ways of looking at bikes in America.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that isn't it true that at least in most of America, we have the idea that bicycles are either for children or for athletes?
I think you definitely see that. And in fact, I mean, you can even tell by the fact that if you see a bicyclist out, there's a high chance the bicyclist will be dressed for the part with a sort of racing outfit and a expensive racing bike, which is, of course, fine. I have no objection to it. But there's another alternative, which is a bike could just be a means of getting around. It doesn't have to be expensive.
And there are places in the world that have a completely different... if you go, places in France?
Sure.
You see a completely different type of populace using bicycles.
I'd venture to say almost anywhere else on Earth, the bike is much more likely to be a means of transportation. And
somebody who looks like an ordinary Joe.
Right. You don't have to be a fitness buff. You don't have to work out, and you don't have to have a cool-looking bike. I can remember getting teased for riding a girl's bike when I was a teenager. I bought my sister's bike, and I learned something about American attitudes toward bikes that way. But I was in the Netherlands a year ago, and everybody rides bikes, men and women that we would have called girls' bikes when I was growing up. And nobody cared about how their bikes looked. They all looked sort of equally crappy. And people actually told me, well, you know, nobody wants to steal an ugly bike. So their bikes were sort of ostentatiously plain. I actually kind of liked the way they looked. But these were not bikes that people were riding around to project a certain image. They were simply a means for getting around. And I think we might have something to learn from that example.
Roads are supposed to connect us, aren't they? Is that how you who are listening think of their purpose? Do you see any ways that maybe roads could be used to better achieve that kind of purpose? 888-WMRA-TALK, how to reach us by phone. Have any observations on how streets and roads may have served to do the opposite of making humans more connected? 888-967-2825. Peter, I remember, it's strange how whenever I talk to you, I end up thinking about my childhood and some of my experiences with family members. But I remember the small rural town where my great-grandparents lived. It was a farmhouse back out on a country road. Most of the neighbors were not close, but they had a porch that wrapped around the front of the house. And so we still got to see people who were walking down this country road or the neighbor who was down the road a little ways. And other relatives who lived closer into the little village that was down the road, almost all of those houses had porches that went around the front of the house. And so people saw each other all the time, as opposed to most homes today, if they have any kind of outdoor decking, it's in the back.
Yeah.
And you don't see your neighbors. Are the kinds of changes that it sounds almost like you're advocating, where we use roads for purposes other than motor vehicles, overcoming that kind of isolation that we got when we took our porches and put them all in the back of the house?
There's a lot of people who see it that way. They see the suburban development we've known, especially since the late 40s, the Levittown of Long Island and the Levittown in Pennsylvania being the archetypes for this automobile subdivision. Those were neighborhoods where there wasn't a front porch. There was more likely a carport on the side. And to a lot of people, this is a loss of local community in the neighborhood. And you do see a big trend towards something that some planners actually call traditional neighborhood design. They even will call it TND. And what they mean by that is, you know, what had been the normal neighborhood design of the pre-automobile age, where you had density, houses were close together with small front yards. And they're redefining density as a good thing rather than as a bad thing, as an opportunity for people to socialize more, as an opportunity to invite other streets, uses of the street besides driving around. And in fact, there are whole communities being built by this new model. There's a particular school of thought in planning, it's a controversial one called New Urbanism. And the new urbanists contend that we do better when we build dense communities, not necessarily large apartment buildings, but dense neighborhoods with houses close together, central spaces like squares or clock towers where people can meet. They tend to be advocates of more traditional-looking architecture, including front porches, which they see as ways to encourage sociability and community building in a neighborhood. And in 1981, they even started a whole town called Seaside, Florida, which is designed completely by these so-called new urbanist ideas. And it is a kind of town where you don't have to drive around for everything. You can walk to a grocery store, for example, or walk to school. And it tends to be a kind of neighborhood where kids can find their friends without having to be taxied around by a parent.
Historian of technology and culture, Peter Norton, our guest. His most recent book titled Fighting Traffic, The Dawn of the Motor Age in the American City. It documents the fascinating story of how America became dependent on the automobile and highways as the primary mode of passenger transportation, while that did not happen in many other industrialized places in the world. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Talk to us a little bit, Peter, before we run out of time, about Australia and a man named David Engwicht?
That's right, yeah. Engwicht. David Engwicht from Brisbane, Australia, has been a controversial guy, a sort of hero to some people, because he takes and has been taking street reclaiming to extremes. He, back in the 90s, organized his neighbors to have something he called street parties. These were not officially approved enterprises, but this was a variation on street reclaiming. They would put furniture out in the street. They'd invite the kids to play in the street to draw motorists' attention to what they were doing. They would put helium balloons tied to the furniture in the street to make it more visible. And whole neighborhoods could temporarily redefine a street as a place to socialize, a place to have parties, and a place to play, and a very kid-friendly place in particular, which maybe that may be the social group that has the most at stake in these new ideas, because the one group you can count on for not being able to get around at will in a car is children. And children in particular seem to really benefit when they have the opportunity to go out and play in the street safely. And David Engwicht in Australia saw it that way. And his idea of street reclaiming or street parties or whatever you want to call it has been very influential. We've been seeing these kinds of things in American streets. There was a huge one in Times Square in 2009 that's become semi-permanent. At least part of Times Square has been turned over for this kind of thing, for play zones for children and adults. And even in Charlottesville, we've had a couple of experimental enterprises like this. For example, a couple of years ago, the Alliance for Community Choice in Transportation in Charlottesville fed some parking meters, curbside parking meters, but instead of using that rented space to store a car, they rolled down some AstroTurf, put some couches out and a coffee table and served juice and had a social hour. And I joined them for part of it. It was a lot of fun. And it was a small version of something like that that's been happening in a lot of cities where in some places they'll actually put down real sod. And you generally need the city's approval to do this. And it's, to me, it's not the most comfortable place to socialize, right next to traffic. But everybody who drives by has something to think about. After they pass by, some of them are at least maybe thinking, oh, you know, maybe we could use streets for something besides moving and storing cars. And I think that's the whole idea behind these so-called parklets.
Is there also a place now called Bicycle City in South Carolina, or am I confusing that with Florida?
You've got it right. In South Carolina, there's a new and this is a corporate investment enterprise, a new subdivision, they don't call it that, residential neighborhood called Bicycle City. They started it about 2 years ago. I'm not certain if they've started to actually rent out houses yet or not. This is near Columbia, the capital, in the central part of South Carolina. And this is going to be a whole town designed so that people can do everything they need to do by walking or bicycling. There's variations on this idea in a lot of places. In Florida, there's a town where a wealthy investor decided that instead of the usual sort of real estate investment, he'd buy up slums and he bought them up. And then he hired the residents of the slums to fix them up and open businesses and create a pedestrian-friendly neighborhood. And so in this town in Florida, he's restored it in such a way that everybody can get to work by walking or bicycling. Some people call this the new pedestrianism.
I know, Peter, how much historians love to predict the future. So you've emphasized that more than 20 years ago, we couldn't have predicted how the internet would have superseded encyclopedias as fonts of knowledge. Can you make a wild guess about where we might be now, 20 years from now, in use of roads and streets that if we hadn't heard you mention it, we might not imagine?
Well, I see two possibilities. One is we'll keep thinking of cars kind of the way Captain Kirk thought of communicators, in a sort of restricted way, and we'll make them more and more efficient and greener, but we'll still use them the same way, and streets will just be for driving. But I'm hoping that we'll have more options than that, and that examples like those set by the street reclaimers and by Bicycle City and by Ciclovia and by some of the new urbanist ideas will give us a bigger menu to choose from and let people finally decide for themselves what they'd like to do with their city spaces.
Sorry, we are out of time.
Yeah, okay. No, that I've said
looking forward to it. Our guest has been historian Peter Norton, author of the book Fighting Traffic, The Dawn of the Motor Age in the American City. Peter, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.